as saying that, look, what is, and, you know, the world, the universe, reality is constituted by a limit. And how do I know this? Well, look at being. Being without limit would be nothing. There would be, it wouldn't hold at all. There, we need something to hold being fast, and Peros, limit, holds that being in place. And when you have that image, what does it render out to? It renders out to a sphere. Now, I think, and this is, so those are the two things to talk about, or that I had sort of comments on what you were saying. But the other thing that we can see in this image of the sphere is the significance of the equality of the sphere, right? What is really important for Parmenides is that if you think about a sphere, so a three-dimensional ball, every single point from the surface of the sphere is the same distance to its center, right? So there is an equality to all of its aspects. What this means is if you took a sphere and you turned it around, it would show itself to you in the same way every time. Whereas if you took anything, so I'm holding a book and I'm turning it, as you turn it, it shows itself in different degrees. But what's interesting about this, and this is kind of one of the ways that I think that you can apply this to small b beings, is that no matter if you take anything at all, you can turn it and it will show itself differently. But what will show itself in equal aspect is its being, right? There's no way that you can turn a book and not see that it is. And this holds true for all things. And this holds true for reality itself, right? There's no aspect of reality that doesn't show that it is. And I think that is one of the sort of, I don't think that the image of the sphere is just a sort of unintuitive image. I think it is meant to instruct us in how to see being, or what being will look like when we see it. And I think that this is what the sphere image is trying to do. It's showing us that no matter when you look at something, or no matter where you see being, it will show itself in the same, it will show itself in the same aspect everywhere. Being is, no matter what.
Yeah, I think that was an excellent and very apt description of that structure. And ultimately, like, we sound repetitive, but the thing is like, you can continue with Parmenides to reduce down that, like, you would just get the same sort of answer every time, that being is, and any kind of differentiation that you're going to make is not, can sort of be plopped into or subsumed by just, like, the fundamental being, right? The way of truth. I think it's worth saying, like, something I wanted to touch on that I didn't feel like we touched on just very briefly from the last episode as much, was, again, talking about, like, why Parmenides is important. He comes up with this radical vision. He's talking specifically about logic, but specifically from a logical perspective rather than a sort of pseudo-naturalist philosophical perspective or observational perspective.
Yeah, he's really the first one, I mean, after the Parmenides, or after the Pythagoreans, who takes this idea of necessity seriously, right?
And getting to necessity, I think one of the important points that really, like, one of the important structures that Parmenides brings to kind of the game of philosophy, the conversation of philosophy, is basically modal logic, right? Like, that is arguably Parmenides' biggest contribution. And, like, modal logic is obviously, just for our listeners, the kind of logic that's used to represent statements about necessity and possibility. And we've been kind of talking, in some ways we don't need to go over it too much, because that's been this whole conversation. But Parmenides is basically bringing in this structure of logic that is basically either saying, you know, X is necessary to be, X is not, X may or may not be. This is still, like, modal logic is still something that is used in, you know, in studies of philosophy, and in the use of logic and mathematics consistently to this day. And this is one of the first places, at least in Western philosophy, where we see this concept really drawn out and used in a system and a picture of the world. And that in itself is very revolutionary, more to the structure and sort of tool bag of philosophical thought.
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons that Parmenides gets taken so seriously, or as I was talking about before, after, if you're coming and doing philosophy after Parmenides and you're not responding to or either accepting or explicitly rejecting these in some ways, as Heraclitus is kind of doing, then you're really missing out on an important contribution in the nature of philosophers are thinkers, and these are tools for thinking, the form of thinking in terms of logic and its modalities in terms of true and false and whatnot. You have to respond to that. This is an important, I guess, inauguration of that.
Parmenides leans into necessity really hard. It is and it must be. That's a stand. We've got a picture of the world. And in the poem, that's what most of the surviving aspects of the poem or pieces of the poem are about. That main section seems to have survived pretty much entirely. However, there's another section, the way of seeming, that gets a lot less attention. Unfortunately, there's a lot less that seems to have survived. But it does appear that Parmenides, you know, in this era of the of philosophers kind of coming and building pictures of the world, you know, sort of accounts of the world from a philosophical perspective, you know, Parmenides came in with this revolutionary, necessity-based world, this monistic world that we've been talking about. But he also gave an account, it appears, of a world of seeming, the world of human interaction, a kind of more pseudo-naturalistic observational perspective that gave some account as to why this is important and how it functions a little bit, and which is obviously radically different.
It's interesting that, and this is a question that some of the commentators in the secondary literature that I read observe, because they're quite curious about why he does this. If Parmenides has had the truth revealed to him, why does the goddess then continue on this road that she said that you shouldn't go down, right? This is the way of seeming is the way that it is and that it is not, right? It is the world according to difference, where things are and are not, right? Where cats are not just cats, but not dogs. But that shouldn't be true if being is, right?
Yeah, actually, to quote Merle Ring in his own account of Parmenides, he kind of brings us up this question that he just has a really nice line here. He says, why was he engaging in cosmological speculation when his metaphysics and logic rendered such an activity unintelligible? Right, so we're entering, you know, this cosmological perspective, this cosmological speculation about how the world is, the world of is and is not, the world of human beings. Well, apparently from, you know, the way of truth, which is obvious, it's the way of truth, it's the true way, this should basically just be BS. Like, it's not. So why is he even bothering doing this? Right? Is an interesting and kind of long thought over philosophical quandary when, in regards to Parmenides.
Well, it's interesting because when I read, so Hussey asks the same question, right? He actually kind of scratches his head and says, there is no reason in the text to suppose why, or there's no, Parmenides doesn't give us anything to figure out why he's doing this. But actually, the commentator, unless I'm like missing something just like so obvious, Parmenides does give us a reason in the text. So I'm going to read from the end of that fragment 8 that we were reading. I'm going to start from where the arguments conclude. So this is Parmenides, this is the goddess kind of dialing back the arguments and transitioning into the way of seeming. She says, and I'm reading from the Waterfield translation. So here I end what I have to tell you of trustworthy arguments and thinking about reality. From this point onward, learn mortal beliefs, listening to words which, though composed, will be lies. For they proposed in their minds to name two forms, one of which should not be named. This is where they went wrong. You know, non-being, difference. They selected things oppositely configured and attributed to them features distinct from one another. To the one form, the bright fire of flame, which is gentle, very light, and in every way the same as itself, but not the same as the other. This too is self-consistent in the opposite manner, as impenetrable night, a dense and heavy body. Okay, here it is. I tell you this way of composing things in all its plausibility, so that never shall any mortal man outstrip you in judgment. This is a vaccine against against appearances, right? She's telling us this story so that we won't have the wool pulled over our eyes when other people give us these cosmologies.
Just a small fragment from that in my own translation from the same section, but the wording, because I think it also lends that way, is noting well the talking about, you know, giving you this account, noting well the deceit in the pattern of my words. So, you know, in that translation was in noting the deceit. Again, like you said, this kind of this vaccine, this readying of education for being like, okay, you've had the truth revealed to you on this journey by the goddess, right? Like, you know, the real deal. But out, like, walking around in the world, people have this alternative illogical picture. Let's, like, try to inoculate you, as you kind of say, or educate you in how to best understand effectively your enemy's perspective.
On this way they journey, deaf and blind, bewildered, indecisive herds in whose thinking being and not being are the same. They're two-headed. They're trying to go two ways at the same time. Not only do you need the truth, because obviously you go up to a cat and you're going to say, so, you know, someone says, that's a cat. You'd be like, man, you have no idea. That's just being. You could have that. You sort of have that ready to hand to supply yourself against the illusion that that's a cat. But at the same time, you need to understand why people buy into this stuff, right? I tell you this way of composing things in all its plausibility. So we're being told, okay, this is a plausible picture. It's not the truth, but here's why people believe this stuff, right? It's not so much the content we're going to be listening for, but listen to how the goddess talks about this content. Now, since light and night have been given all names and been predicated of this and that in accordance with their powers, everything is full of light and dark, night at once, and of both equally, since neither of them contains what is not. Obviously, according to the way of seeming, light is not night, and night is not light, but the goddess is saying, look, these are actually equally the same thing. So as we go down this sort of ladder into the appearance of things, we're constantly being reminded that things are equal, right? So this is one of the ways that the vaccine is being administered. We're going to go through the same old story. I'll get into this in a second, but we're going to go through the same old story that we've been hearing time and again, and we're going to note that everywhere difference is introduced, there is no difference. There is just being. And I say that this is us kind of going through the same old story, because if you think about it, I mean, it's really curious that Parmenides would do something so radically new, right? Take a journey into the underworld and receive the truth from the goddess, and then all of a sudden just break into cosmology, which we've been doing since Hesiod, right? So we had Hesiod's Theogony, we had Pherecydes, Anaximander did this as well. And apparently, I mean, there's just numbers of cosmologies being given. At this point, it's not, I don't want to say it's like a tired genre or anything, but it would be a bit surprising if Parmenides, this revolutionary thinker, just does that again, right? So what Parmenides is doing is repurposing cosmology as a vaccine against cosmology, right? Going through this same story and pointing out, okay, here's where they're wrong, and still noting that all of these things hold, right? Like, there's some interesting, attempts at what we would call scientific inquiry in this, but it has the ultimate purpose of serving the truth.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, as you get into that, okay, we're not saying this vaccine, he's giving us this cosmological account, that cosmological account is reflective of the structure of prior kind of cosmological accounts in he really describes a kind of dualism, right? Like you brought it before, there's, okay, the world is built up of two separate things. You've got light and you've got night. the important part is that they're opposites. And right, you see this especially in part, you know, in the, you know, pre-Socratic Greek world, especially in, you know, like kind of early scientific cosmological thought, you see this idea pop up again and again. You know, you've got hot and cold, wet and dry.
Yeah. When we move into Empedocles, that's going to get systematized as well, right?
Yeah, and so you have this is, at the time, a pretty, in many ways, I would say, probably conventional way. This is the way that many people were used to thinking about stuff. Okay, the world is going to be made up of two opposing forces. You even see this a little bit in Heraclitus, right? That the world is made up of a kind of tension, right? That sort of orders things. And so Parmenides basically goes through light and night. And there's still something I'm trying to figure out here in terms of what those concepts will be, because if we remember, our listeners remember, and we'll obviously remember at the beginning of the poem, Parmenides makes a point of actually saying that he goes from night to the light, right? Like that the goddess is actually taking him from one to the other and leaving the other behind to only have, you know, the day, right? Which is presumably the truth. And there's this kind of picture of, again, of purity versus mixing in terms of creating the truth or an accurate picture of the world.
Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't considered that Parmenides is he's exiting one realm and entering another. And according to that cosmological picture, that should be the move from the world of, or that should be the move from it is not to it is, which would make a lot of sense considering that Parmenides receives the way of the way of truth or the way of being that it is. But what's interesting in this is that we can't just think of this in terms of mixture, right? Like we want to think of, well, everything that is not something else, right? That is the way of seeming. Specifically, if he's moving from night to light, that's a world of not. He's moving from a world that isn't into a world that is. So I find that interesting.
Yeah, and perhaps even when you say it like that, maybe he didn't mean it that simply, but there's something to that. You're moving from the world that isn't, the observable world, the world of appearances, to the world that is. In the cosmology, he says in Fragment 9, all things are full of light and of obscure night. So there's this real emphasis that there, you're going to have in the world of appearances, the world of man, in the world, which we often will, and later, we'll talk about more in terms of becoming, that for becoming to be, there has to be a tension from one to the other and back to the other, basically. You know, if a tree is going to grow, there has to be some tension in terms of it, you know, taking space from something else, or going from being small to being big, from being young to being old, right? This trend, from being alive to being dead, that whole process involves these transitions of opposites that Parmenides, obviously in his monistic world, the true world, doesn't make any sense, right? Like, how could you have something be taller or smaller or older or younger in a world where everything is just one?
Yeah, his cosmology tries to give an account of the plausibility of their relationship by saying, look, they're the same thing, right? However, what happened was someone said it is not, right? Old is not young. Dead is not alive. You know, tall is not short. That's where they went wrong. If we give the two-headed herd a sympathetic reading, we can come to elaborate that the consequences of that, but ultimately it's mistaken. Tall and short, they both are, and they depend on each other. They have a relationship in that way.
It seems quite historically likely from available evidence that Parmenides had some very close relationships with the Pythagoreans, and that way of seeming probably had some influence on them. And Merle says, one possible Pythagorean hangover in Parmenides' cosmology concerns the extent to which Parmenides thought one of the two ultimate principles was more moral worth than the other. Recall that on the Pythagorean list of opposites, good was included under the heading of limited and bad under the unlimited column. Which one is the limited and the one unlimited? Just for our listeners, obviously the limited is actually the monistic world. And the unlimited is this sort of chaotic world of tension where things are constantly coming to be and passing away and all, you know, it's chaotic. Whereas, like, you know, the Pythagoreans, especially with their, you know, affinity towards sort of mathematical structure and purity, there's something morally good, there's something more trustworthy about a world that is effectively simple in its structure.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I can, it's interesting that the commentator brings that up, because I know precisely where that placement of good and bad according to Peirce, or according to Limit and Unlimit, comes from. It's from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, where he well, you can't quote Pythagoras because he didn't write anything down as far as we know, but he says that the Pythagoreans say that the good is limited and the bad is unlimited. And this goes on to sort of corroborate his own geometry of ethics. He goes on and he formulates the golden rule out of that. There is an interesting way in which good and bad before Aristotle and, you know, before Plato might have had like a pre-moralized sense. Like we talk with Aristotle, we talk about a knife being good, but we don't, you know, we don't blame or shame knives for being bad knives. When we talk about the moral, like where do we place morality in this? That might actually be like a later, you know, the idea of like responsibility for one's actions and whatnot. Might be an Aristotelian sort of import into this, but it is a really interesting sort of observation or wonder about, you know, does someone who adheres to the limit and who observes where limits actions in a certain way, does that necessarily make actions more good according to Aristotle? And I'm quite convinced by it that is true.
There's definitely some reflective connecting going on for sure, because obviously Aristotle is quite a bit after, even though, again, it goes back to how old the people we're talking about here. Like we're talking about Aristotle, like he's the newer guy on the block compared to Parmenides, right? Throughout the poem, there is this kind of emphasis, particularly from the goddess, right? Like the fact that he's with the goddess, the fact that the goddess is encouraging him one way, the fact that the goddess also speaks somewhat disparagingly of the structure of reality of human beings, that there is this kind of tilt towards a sort of moralism, that effectively the world of man, the world of seeming, the world of becoming is bad. Like it's like a trick, and truth is, you know, even in the structure of the poem, it's, you know, you go through these, you know, these gates, and, you know, you're enveloped in this kind of, you know, in the light, the goodness, the warmth, the true. Parmenides is not giving this poem because he thinks that, like, you know, people shouldn't care about the truth and the way of, you know, of truth.
No, specifically at early on, I emphasized as well in the first episode that this is something that you're supposed to pass on and share, you know, share this. I mean, this is a revelation. I think a lot of what we call pre-Socratic philosophy got systematized and seen and sort of read into as being proto-scientific, even though I do think it is proto-scientific. I think a lot of what we are reading is the roots of natural inquiry, and like that's not a later reading. Even Aristotle says that, right? The naturalist says, okay, they made a lot of mistakes, but these people are doing what I'm doing before me, right? But even in that sense, Parmenides comes off as prophetic, kind of almost shamanic in a way. He's moving between worlds. He's encountering, I think this is a really good sort of dramatic reading of it as well. It goes more to it as a text than just as like a philosophical argument. Parmenides as a character is a mortal being delivered to a goddess, and the goddess is delivering the truth, and that truth will come with all the goodness that truth delivers, and that will also come with, you know, an encouraging goddess and one who teaches you the right way to do things and who to associate with. It's interesting that the goddess does say, like, okay, you should pass this on to other mortals, even though mortals are kind of disparaged. But that doesn't, I mean, I don't know, she receives Parmenides, and Parmenides is a mortal, so that makes there is a certain sort of insertion of the divine into the world in that way. And I think that's one way that we can understand Parmenides, is like, if people call Parmenides a prophet, that's one way we might understand it.
Yeah, and I hesitate to say this because it's a very loaded term, but I think compared to a lot of the texts that we've covered so far, particularly in the not just its content, but more in its form, that it has a pseudo, almost spiritual aspect to it. It's trying to convince you of, like, a higher way, or reveal to you a higher way of being, rather just explaining, as the prior philosophers have done in the pre-Socratic tradition, of how the world is. This is basically meant to be, like, eliciting to you, hey, the world is actually this way, and it's the right way, right? As crazy as it sounds, like as you're saying, like, you know, this is supposed to be shared, like, come join the goddess too, come on this journey with me, let me show you why everyone else is basically wrong, like, and I'm right, and that, like, and you will be rewarded for your transition to the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Peter Kingsley, he has a reading of the poem as an initiatory text. It's actually, so he reads the sounds at the beginning of the poem, you know, the rattling of the gate and the squeaking of the wheel. Those are supposed to be sort of sensory inputs to bring you into a trance-like state where you will imbibe the text on a different level of consciousness. So that reading, it has sympathetic readers. We've gone through the entirety of the poem at this point. With the way of seeming, we only have fragments, unfortunately, and we've had to bounce between the fragments that inform our reading of it. We've worked through all of the major extant passages. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host, Brandon, and I've been joined by Hale.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
CJSF's Fun Drive starting October 28th to November 3rd. Thank you.